Now, what I want to talk to you about tonight is why positive thinkers get positive results. And they do, too, that's for sure. One reason that the positive thinker gets positive results is he is not afraid of a problem. As a matter of fact, he finds problems exciting. He likes to take a tough, knotty problem and rip it apart and put it together again in the right manner. He doesn't run away from problems. He doesn't complain about problems. He likes problems. Now, this phenomenon known as a problem isn't what you might call the most popular in this land of the free and the home of the brave. I rather get the notion that the average person thinks that life would be simply wonderful if we had fewer problems, or easier problems, or better still, no problems whatsoever. Now, I should like to ask you, would you actually be better off if you had fewer problems, or easier problems, or no problems at all? Let me answer that question by telling you of an incident. I was walking down Fifth Avenue, New York City, not so long ago, when I saw approaching me a friend of mine from out of town by the name of George. It was evident from George's melancholy and disconsolate demeanor that he wasn't, you might say, filled to overflowing with the ecstasy and exuberance of human existence, which is a high-class way of saying that George was dragging bottom. He was really low. Well, this excited my natural sympathy, so I asked him, "How are you, George?" Now, when you get right down to it, that was nothing but a routine inquiry. But it represented an enormous mistake on my part. For George took me seriously. And for 15 minutes, he enlightened me meticulously on how badly he felt. And the more he talked, the worse I felt. So finally I said, "Well, George, what seems to be the trouble? What's bothering you? I'd like to help you if I could." This really set him off. "Oh," he says, "it's these problems. Problems. Nothing but problems. I am fed up with problems." And he got so exercised about the matter that he quite forgot who he was talking to. And he began to castigate these problems vitriolically, using in the process thereof, I am sad to relate, a great many theological terms. Though he didn't put them together in a theological manner, that's for sure. But I knew what he meant all right, for he had what the super erudite call the power to communicate. I said, "George, you'd like to get rid of these problems, would you?" He said, "And how? I would like to be rid of every problem." Well, I always like to help people any way I can, so I meditated and ruminated and cogitated on the situation and came up with a solution which I personally thought wasn't half bad. At least it was the truth. I said, "George, the other day, I was up in the northern part of New York City, in the Bronx, on professional business, if I may thus characterize it, and I was in an area up there where the head man told me that by actual count, there were 150,000 people, and not a single one of them had a problem." The first enthusiasm I saw in George suffused his countenance and lighted up his eyes as he said to me, "Boy, that's for me. Lead me to this place." I said, "Okay, you asked for it. It's Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx." And this is a fact. Nobody in Woodlawn has a problem. For them, life's fitful fever is over. They rest from their labors. They couldn't care less what you and I will see on television tonight or read in tomorrow morning's newspaper. They have no problems at all, large or small, but they are dead. It therefore follows, I believe, in logical sequence that problems constitute a sign of life. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the more problems you have, the more alive you are. The man who has, let's say, 10 good old tough man-sized problems is twice as alive as the poor, miserable, apathetic character who only has 5 problems. And if you here tonight have no problems at all, I warn you, you are in great jeopardy. You're on the way out and you don't know it. What you better do, the minute this meeting is over, don't fool around. Head for home. And go to your room and shut the door and get down on your knees by the bed and pray to the Lord and say to the Lord, Lord, please, what's the matter? Don't you trust me anymore? Give me some problem. Why, one sometimes wonders what's come over this great country. We are the descendants of a once great breed of men who had problems, and they had them aplenty. But did they whine and whimper and crawl through life on their hands and knees, piteously complaining because of their problems? Not on your life. They were philosophers. They were thinkers. And they understood the construction of the universe. And they knew that at the center of this world in which we live is this phenomenon known as a problem. And furthermore, they weren't afraid of problems. They stood up to them because they knew that every problem contains its own solution. The world is full of problems. For what reason? Why do we have so many problems? Why do you have so many problems? There's one answer to that. It is that you will grow strong so that you're more and more capable of handling problems. The only way you make a strong man is through resistance, struggle, pain, frustration, disappointment. This makes men. I'll go so far as to say that I don't believe any individual can really be mentally healthy who hasn't got a proper philosophy of a problem. Mental health is a very precarious thing. And you couldn't get this many people together without having somebody here for whom that's a problem. Maybe more of us than we'd care to admit. Now, if you want to know whether you're healthy mentally, tell you what you do. Take a piece of paper and write down on it your usual reactions when you have to face a tough problem. Do you ask, why me? Do you say, why isn't it the other fella? Do you say, why do I have all these troubles? Why do I have so many difficulties? Do you whine, you whimper, and you complain? If that's what appears on the sheet of paper when you give this honest self-analysis, then you might very well have the mental health checked. Down in my church in New York City, I've got 15 psychiatrists on the staff of the church. I don't want you to get any false notions as to my congregation by reason of this. You might ask, why in the world would you even have one psychiatrist on the staff? Well, the idea is we believe in dealing with people scientifically. How in the world are you going to get a man well if you don't know why he's sick? So for years, I've had these psychiatrists as consultants. Now, I don't know whether there's any psychiatrist in this meeting here tonight or not. But if there should be one here, he's not going to be hurt by anything I say. For I respect him highly as a scientist and even have affection for him as a colleague. But having made these felicitous remarks, I will admit to you in the intimacy of the little family circle here that having been closely associated with these psychiatrists for 25 long years, they sure are a queer crowd. But if any one of them had the floor in my stead, he might with equal authenticity make a not dissimilar comment on my profession, that's for sure. There, for example, is the problem of worry, which lots of people have. The seriousness of worry is indicated by the meaning of the word itself. The English word worry is derived from an old Anglo-Saxon word, wyrgan, W-Y-R-G-A-N, which meant literally to strangle or to choke. If I were to come out in the audience and grab you around the neck and press as hard as I could, pressing, cutting off your air supply, I would be doing to you dramatically what you do to yourself if over a long period of time you're a victim of worry. You are strangling your creative power. And then we have fear, which is worry in depth, and which is described by a brilliant New England psychiatrist as the most disintegrating enemy of human personality. We have anxiety problems. And another psychiatrist appraises anxiety as the great modern plague. Now, the positive thinker is an individual who's gotten himself healthy-minded. And he knows that he'll always be dealing with problems. So he undertakes to do them in a very efficient and effective manner. So that's it. The first element in the reason for a positive thinker getting positive results is his attitude toward a problem. Well, the second thing about a positive thinker and why he gets positive results is that he thinks positively. Now, it's very important how you think. Actually, you can destroy yourself or you can create yourself by the manner and quality of your thoughts. Now, there are essentially two kinds of thinking, negative and positive. The individual who thinks negatively does a very dangerous thing. He constantly sends out of his mind negative emanations that activate the world around him negatively. And I'd like to tell you a little incident in my own self-education as I conclude, hoping that it may be of some benefit to you. I happen to have a farm up in Dutchess County, New York. And some years ago, some of my neighbors got together one night at a dinner party. Now, as I remember it, there were present at this dinner party that night quite a galaxy of people, and they all lived around there. One was Tom Dewey, who was governor of our state. Another was Lowell Thomas, dean of American Broadcasters. There was also there Eddie Rickenbacker, and Mr. J.C. Penny, and a number of others. And this was a very interesting group of people, all of whom had ideas. And it is always exhilarating and stimulating to associate with people who have ideas. So they got to talking about what did this country need more than anything else. And they finally decided that what this country needed more than any other thing was a new type of magazine that would have a positive connotation to it, that would be filled with articles and stories of a dramatic nature about people who had overcome some great problem. And they got very excited about this. And along about 11 o'clock, they decided actually to inaugurate this magazine. They even named it. They called it Guideposts. And about 11:30, they elected me editor of this magazine and told me to go out and start it. I said, well, gentlemen, I sure do appreciate this election as editor of a non-existent magazine. But I said, even though I am a preacher, I wasn't born yesterday, and I know that in order to successfully float any such enterprise, you've got to have a little of this green stuff that's commonly referred to as capital. And I said, I haven't any available myself, but I do happen to know that all of you are very well healed. Therefore, I will now pass among you for subscriptions. Now, friends, I am sometimes pained by the reactions of human nature, as in this instance, the alacrity with which these men suddenly discovered that the hour was late and they had to go home. And they left me, the editor of a non-existent magazine, with no capital and no publishing know-how, which was, you might reasonably say, an unpropitious situation. And I was about to chuck the thing in the wastebasket. But the idea had got hold of me. And I had to have some money, though, to float it. So I sat down and I said to myself, where can I get some capital? Who do I know who is very well off, who is at the same time of a generous disposition? It was only later that I was to discover that these two qualities are seldom found in the same person. But I happened to think of a friend of mine named Frank Gannett, who lived at Rochester, New York. Now, Frank was kind-hearted and humanitarian. He was a pushover for anything that had any good objective. So I went up to Rochester and I gave Frank a sales talk. Told him what this magazine was going to do and how I needed some money to help get it started. And after a long sales talk, he gave me $700. Now, why in earth give me $500 or $1,000 even money, I'll never know. But he gave me $700. But I never believe in looking the gift horse in the face. And I took the $700, but now I had the $700 and I hadn't the slightest idea what to do with it. Except I knew for sure I wasn't going to give it back to Frank. Then I heard there's a business in this country called the list, L-I-S-T business. You can buy any old kind of a list, but the most expensive list is what's referred to in the trade as the good givers list. I wanted to send out a mailing. So I bought $700 worth of the good givers list and sent out a mailing. And got back $7,000, which I figured wasn't a bad return on the investment. And with this $7,000, we built up this magazine Guidepost. We got it finally up to 40,000 subscribers. It depended for success upon volume sales, and volume sales was what we didn't have. But we did get it up to 40,000. But costs were mounting more rapidly than the increase of our circulation, and we were getting into a bad way. I might say parenthetically, and I never did forget it, I got some of the nastiest letters from the suppliers that you can possibly imagine. For example, the man who sold us a typewriter on time, lots of time, wrote me the nastiest letter. Wanting to know why we didn't pay for the typewriter. I never even answered him. For any fool Holmes should have known. We didn't have any money. That was... Well, finally, we got so that we were just about to fold. And I called a meeting of the board of directors. Now, you may have been in gloomy meetings in your lifetime, but you were never in one as abysmally gloomy as this one. You could cut it with a knife. The directors sat down here along a table. Now, I had a stack of bills, the biggest stack of bills I ever saw. I got one of those old spindles that's about 4 foot high and put these bills on the spindles, and those bills had other uncomplimentary remarks on them and old dates. So I plunked these bills right down in front of my director, and I wanted to develop a bill psychology. I said, "Look at those bills," and let a dead silence fall. Finally, after a while, the fellow down the end spoke up and he says, "What do you know? Look at those bills." The most profoundly creative remark I ever heard in my life. Now, we had invited a woman to this meeting, and you probably wonder why, and I can enlighten you, because on one previous occasion, this woman had donated $2,500 cash money to Guidepost, and we figured that maybe lightning might strike twice in the same day. So while our conversation was ostensibly directed to one another, it was actually pinpointed to her. So finally, she spoke up and she said, "Can I say a word?" "Well," I said, "yes, we'd be delighted to hear from you." I said, "I don't know whether you will or not." She said, "You know, I get the notion that you gentlemen are hoping that I will give you some more money." "Why," I said, "how in the world would you get that idea?" "Well," said, "I'm going to put you out of your misery. I'm not going to give you another nickel." This didn't put us out of our misery, but more deeply into it. She asked me, she said, "Do you know why I won't give you any more money?" I said, "Why won't you give us any more money?" She said, "Because I don't think you got a proper philosophy of money." I said, "What do you mean, a philosophy of money?" She said, "What is your philosophy of money?" I said, "It's to pay these bills." She said, "That's just what I thought." "Why," she said, "if I give you more money, it'll just go down the same drain like good money after bad, and you'll continue to be in debt." But she said, "A proper philosophy of money is that a man knows that money in itself has no inherent value. It's only a tool by which an imaginative person builds something." Well, I wasn't interested in any philosophy of money. I was interested in the cold cash. But she said, "I tell you what I will do. I won't give you any money, but I'll give you something of far greater value than money." Well, that astonished me because I couldn't figure anything of greater value. She said, "I will give you a creative and dynamic prosperity idea. And with this idea, you can get all the money you need to float this magazine." Now, she said, "Let's face the situation. Why are we in the situation we're in?" She said, "We lack, L-A-C-K, everything, don't we?" I said, "Yes, we do." "Well," then she asked, "why do we lack everything?" Now, right now, what I'm going to say is one of the greatest ideas that anybody ever gave to me. She said, "We lack money, we lack subscribers, we lack equipment, we lack imagination, we lack ideas, we lack support." And she asked, "Why do we lack everything?" And she answered her own question. She says, "We lack everything because we have constantly, consistently been thinking in terms of lack, and we have thereby created a condition of lack." Now, I'd never heard anything like that in my life before, and I scratched my head. I said, "Well, we do lack. And we have been thinking lack." Oh, I said, "Maybe the girl has something." Her point was that you yourself in your thinking create the condition that actualizes. and I said, what are we going to do about it? Why, what are we going to do about it, she said. You got to stand up and tell these lack thoughts to get out of your mind. Now, this lady's name was Tessie. And I said, look, Tessie, what you say proves essentially that you're an uneducated woman. Because any psychologist in the world will tell you that if you mount a frontal attack on an unhealthy thought pattern, instead of exorcising it or driving it out, you drive it more deeply into consciousness. And I added, we don't control our thoughts. Our thoughts control us. I'll never forget the look of disgust that registered on her face as she said, that is the most puerile thing I ever heard anybody say, that you don't control your thoughts. And she asked me, don't you remember what the great Plato said? Well, frankly, I hadn't the slightest idea what the great Plato said. But I didn't want to reveal my ignorance, so I said brightly, to which of the many familiar statements of Plato do you refer? She said, I refer to the one you never heard of in your whole life. I shall never forget hearing Tessie say what Plato said. And this is it. Take charge of your thoughts. You can do what you will them. Well, I said, all right, what are we going to do about the lack thoughts? She said, flush them out. I said, when do you want us to flush them out? She said, right now. So we sat there for 15 minutes flushing out these lack thoughts, which I'll recommend as a good daily exercise. All right, she said, you can stop flushing now. Your minds are empty. Which in your case, she added, didn't take very long. Now she said that your minds are empty. You've got to act fast because the human mind will not for long remain empty. And these lack thoughts are sitting out here now, ready to get back in where they've been so hospitably received for so long. The only way you can keep them out is to substitute something and substitute it fast. Now she said, I want to ask you a question. Would you like to have a prosperity dynamic thought substituted for the lack thoughts? I said, I sure would. All right, she said, how many subscribers do you need to keep this magazine going? I didn't know, but I pulled a figure out of the air. I said, 100,000 I believe would do it. She said, you have 40,000. I said, yes, you need 60,000 more. I said, yes, smart girl, go to the head of the class. All right, she said, do you want that 100,000 subscribers? I said, we certainly do. All right, she said, I want you to look out there and I want you in your mind to see 100,000 people who have paid a subscription for Guidepost. And I looked out and I said, they look mighty dim. Then I happened to turn around and I looked into Tessie's eyes. Now, Tessie doesn't belong to my church. She's a Jewish woman. One of the greatest combinations of spirituality and sagacity I ever knew in my life. I looked into her eyes. She's just diminutive. Big black eyes, however. And as I looked into her eyes, a phrase crossed my mind. The exalted look of the believer. There is a kind of personality that appears once in a while in this world called the believer. And he it is who sweeps everything before him. He believes great things into being. In the minute I saw this believer look in her eyes, I saw reflected there. I actually did, so help me, my 100,000 subscribers. And I leaped to my feet and I said, what do you know? I see them, I see them. And she leaped to her feet and she says, isn't that great? Now that we see them, we have them. I said, how's that? Ah, yes, she said, now that we see them, we have them. And she added, now let's get down on our knees and thank the Lord that he's given us 100,000 subscribers. Well, now, friends, I'll pray with anybody at any time. And I got down on my knees with Tessie. But privately, I thought it was sure pushing the Lord awful far. But I want to tell you something. You should have heard the prayer Tessie offered. I've heard some of the littlest prayers in my lifetime. I've offered some of them myself. But this was a terrific prayer. She didn't ask the Lord for anything. She thanked him for everything in advance. Including our 100,000 subscribers. And I got so excited, I could hardly wait for her to say amen. And the minute she did, I leaped to my feet and looked down to where those bills had been. And there they still were. I had the idea that the Lord was going to come down with some sweet chariot and carry them all away. That in the way he does business. When he wants to change the situation, how does he do it? By some magical means? Not at all. He changes people, and changed people change situations. And that's exactly what happened here. She began to develop ideas about seed money. And creative ideas. My directors now came unfrozen, and they began to throw ideas out on the table. One after the other, lots of them. About 90% of them weren't any good. But now their brains were working at full capacity. They were thinking positively. They were seeing creativity in action. And about 10% of those ideas took hold, with the result that these bills melted away. And tonight, Guidepost has not 100,000 subscribers, but 2,150,000 subscribers. And the magazine is said by DeWitt Wallace, owner of the Reader's Digest, the greatest publishing sensation in history, that Guidepost is the greatest nonprofit, interfaith, inspirational magazine ever established in the United States. And it's taken now by over 2,000 firms, for all or part of their employees. It's the 23rd magazine in the United States in point of readership. Now, I don't say all this to advertise Guidepost. Though I do, incidentally, receive the byproducts of any illustration that I may happen to use. But I say this because it illustrates the law, a great law, of successful achievement. And what is that law, in brief? If you want to accomplish any great thing in this world, in any line of business, number one thing is to pray about it. For you pray about it to be sure it's a right thing. For if it isn't a right thing, it's a wrong thing, and no wrong thing ever turned out right. And then secondly, you form a goal. You establish an objective, not a fuzzy one, but a sharp, defined goal, so that you know exactly where it is you want to go. Then you test this goal to be sure it's right. Then you put it in the conscious mind, and you hold it there until, by a process of intellectual osmosis, it sinks into the unconscious. And when it gets into the unconscious, you have it, because it has all of you. And you give it constantly the good old positive follow through. So there you have it. The attitude toward a problem as a creative, exciting challenge and opportunity, every one of which contains the seeds of its own solution. You think positively in order to send out positive emanations to reproduce themselves in kind in positive results. And on this basis, and by this method, positive thinkers always get positive results.